You can probably think of a time or two when you saw a political figure speaking and wondered, what language are they speaking? One answer is Spinglish, the combination of English and spin featured in a brand new book, a dictionary of sorts by Henry Beard and Christopher Cerf. Both of our guests have spent plenty of time in the land of mirth and Muppets. Henry Beard was one of the founders of National Lampoon after working at Harvard Lampoon. He's the author of 50 or so books, including Miss Piggy's Guide to Life. Christopher Cerf has worked at Random House a few times. His father founded it. He was a contributing editor to National Lampoon. And in his long history with Sesame Street, he's written more than 300 songs. Very much a pleasure to have you, Christopher Cerf.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks, Jeff.
And good to have you, Henry Beard, as well.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. Nice to be here.
So, Henry, let's start with you. What got the project started? And for God's sake, why not years earlier, given the subject matter?
Well, actually, it was started years earlier. Chris Cerf and I wrote a pair of books, The Official Politically Correct Dictionary and Handbook and The Official Sexually Correct Dictionary and Handbook, which kind of opened our eyes, because that's a special area of speech, and you're just playing with the language to try to appear to be more sensitive. But we realized that that was just the tip of the iceberg, as it were, that the language was being twisted and manipulated all over the place, in politics, you know, Wall Street, Hollywood, even real estate ads, in ways that we never expected, and to a degree that it just astonished us.
Chris, was there I have to believe at this point you might have written a song about the bad use of language.
Well, I'm not sure I've ever done that, but maybe it's time. Maybe it's time.
Was there a particular incident when someone strayed far enough from English to get you out of a chair, Chris, to make you go, oh, my God, we got to do something about this?
Well, I think, you know, it was kind of cumulative, but we started seeing words that just kind of amazed us. For example, I read that companies that put lots of sugar in their products didn't want people to know that anymore because it wasn't considered healthy and it's becoming kind of a scandal. So they decided to use the term evaporated cane juice in their ingredients list instead, which sounds very healthy and most people don't even notice it.
Well, they certainly got me because the first time I saw that, I said, well, how bad could that be? It's not just pure white sugar, but it really is, isn't it?
Well, it's exactly the same thing. But the whole point of Spinglish is that all these words are meant to sound like something they don't really mean. They're meant to deceive you, which is really the difference between political correctness that Henry was talking about a minute ago and Spinglish. And political correctness might have a political motive, but most of the time it's to appear more sensitive or to try to get people to be more sensitive, whereas these words are really designed to deceive the person hearing them.
Henry, I think you guys point out in the book, this isn't just for politicians and institutions. Do we, just regular folks, use Spinglish in daily life?
Oh, yeah, we always do. I mean, it's a simple matter of just getting used to the fact that, you know, we don't have garbage collectors anymore. We talk about our sanitation engineers. We don't have garbage dumps. We go take the crap out to a resource development park. It's hard to stop yourself from using this stuff because it's become so inured in just the way we think. And it's not just that we're not trying to offend people. We're often trying to hide the fact that we know that we're doing something a little, you know, maybe not exactly right.
Well, to be fair, though, Henry, I mean, is it just that some people want to sound smart by using big words, or is it often a lot more deliberately misleading than that?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's always been the case that, you know, since the English language is really made up of a whole bunch of languages, but chiefly of, you know, Anglo-Saxon and, more importantly, Latin, which has multisyllabic words that make it look like you went to college. But I think what's happened in the last 20 or 30 years, and it's partly, you know, accelerated by social media, is that people have caught on to the fact that you can disguise all kinds of behavior just by using language. And a classic example I can give you is we used to fire people, but now we attrition them, we bangalore them, we decruit them, we dehire them, we deinstall them, we deselect them, we excess them, we future endeavor them, we involuntarily leisure them, let them go, make them available to the industry, make them redundant, manage them for value, non-renew, offer a package to them, outplace, present with an early retirement opportunity, send in phase retirement, severance, surplus, or unassigned.
You know, actually, even before I read the book, when I was writing a web blurb for this, I used the term right size, and sure enough, that appears, you know, there's so many. Bangalore, though, that's a new one until I read the book.
That's when you send the job to India.
Ah, okay. You guys, Chris, you write in the book that the English is uniquely positioned or vulnerable to be spun. Is it because of those Latin and Anglo-Saxon roots?
Well, that's really a large part of it. If you want to sometimes spin is making something sound worse than it really is. Like you might say death tax instead of inheritance tax if you want people to vote against it. So the Anglo-Saxon words tend to be very good for making things sound worse because they're very blunt, whereas the Latin words, as Henry mentioned, make you sound very learned, or maybe the words will just flow by without your paying any attention.
All right, so since you mentioned the death tax and uses of terms of that, I want to come right up to this. There's a big section in the book about Sarah Palin's use of the term death panels. First, do we know who's behind the creation of the term? And second, is it any surprise that such terms seem to live on like zombies even after, as in that case, they're identified as lies, and in that case, the lie of the year?
Well, I think probably... because people retweet things. The Internet is making some of these things live on. But, of course, there really aren't any death panels. That's what made that such a wonderful example of spin. And actually what Sarah Palin wrote was, "The America I know and love is not one in which my parents and my baby with Down syndrome will have to stand in front of Obama's death panel so his bureaucrats can decide." She didn't even claim, if you read that carefully, that there were death panels. She just said the America she knew and loved wouldn't have them. And yet, because people don't listen very carefully, that was retweeted and repeated everywhere so often that everybody came to think that the Obamacare really had death panels.
Frank Luntz,
a very good example of spin being used effectively.
Absolutely. Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster, gets mentioned a few times in the book. Is he one of the best spinners around, you think?
Frank Luntz, did you say?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, absolutely. He is actually someone that we admire, maybe not for everything he believes, but certainly for his ability to create these terms. The death tax term was his, and something very clever that he taught Republicans to do on climate change, and in fact that's another one of his terms because he feels it sounds less threatening than global warming, but on climate change he really suggested that that Republicans say that all the facts aren't in yet, and it would be irresponsible to act before all the facts are in. And, of course, if you're impulsive, that's not necessarily a good thing. So he kind of changes the argument with his language very, very brilliantly.
He really does.
Over and over again.
The book is called Spinglish. Christopher Cerf and Henry Beard, his authors and our guests, back on the Jefferson Exchange with them and you in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to the authors of Spinglish, the Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language, Henry Beard and Christopher Cerf, both with very long resumes and a number of endeavors, including the National Lampoon together. And yes, I still have my old copies of National Lampoon anniversary editions on the shelves at home, so good to talk to you guys. You can join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at home, at work, wherever you are, 800-838-3760. Anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I haven't mentioned so far, looks like we lost somebody here. I'm not sure which one. Okay, so we got one of you. Who's still left?
Well, I'm still here. I think Chris, are you still there?
It looks like Chris dropped off. Okay, so hey, we got
you. He must have a phone issue. We don't call them problems.
You've gotten really good at this.
It's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Did you guys make some of these up, like alcluistic? I mean, some of these are really comedy writer's dream.
No, I want to really emphasize that there's like 45 pages of footnotes. Every single one of these we found almost entirely on the Internet. We have the strict rule that as tempting as it might be, because this stuff is so ridiculous, we did not make any of them up. Now, some of them sounded silly enough that it's clear that somebody did make them up, but almost everybody who made them up for a purpose, and generally the purpose wasn't to make you laugh.
Really, it was really just to obfuscate things, or just to soften up the edge. You know, I mean, euphemisms we all learned about in elementary school, I think, but you know, this goes beyond euphemism, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you have to realize the euphemisms is a wonderful term called the euphemism treadmill. If you think about it, the first terrible economic problems that happened at the end of the 19th century was a panic, or there was a crash, and then people decided that was too rugged, so it became the depression. Now, depression is such a horrible word, they used recession for a while, and recession has become so bad, we now use a temporary downturn in economic activity. it's a habit that's hard to break out of, but you see why people do it.
I do, but, you know, it's really interesting, too, being a lifelong broadcaster, that everything we're taught to do is to say things more simply, you know? You don't even say the price of gasoline, you say gas prices, you know? You get the of out of there. All the extraneous words go, and yet we're working generally talking to people who want to add words back in.
That's right, but because, of course, one of the great responsibilities which you exercise so well, the media has to clear away all the verbiage and get back to the truth and recognize that these terms are being used deliberately to deceive and to obfuscate. And I think the media is very good at that, and that's why you have things like what Chris was talking about, where they spot the fact that death tax is really referring to the estate tax. And when politicians say things like mistakes were made instead of I made a mistake, that's a deliberate attempt to kind of soften the blow.
Chris, are you back with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Okay. So the book is divided into two main sections. Why don't you tell our listeners what those are?
Pardon? I didn't hear that, Jeff.
Two main sections in the book. Can you tell us what those are?
Oh, yes. Well, the main section, or the longer section, is Spinglish to English, where we have an alphabetical listing of all these spin terms, all the ones that we found, and there are literally thousands of them, and we sort of define them and explain where they came from. Then the second part of the book is the reverse. It's like a language dictionary. The second part is from English to Spinglish. And the reason we have that is so that you yourself can find something you want to say but you know will trouble people and say it in Spinglish instead. So, for example, if you were to look up slashing benefits, if you were a politician, you could say that you were doing entitlement reform instead, which sounds so much better.
It does indeed better than slashing benefits. And, you know, Henry was just saying as we were getting you connected again, something I want to underscore here, that these are real examples. The book is packed with notes in the back. This is like an academic work with all these attributions to where things were said.
Well, yes, and you know, partly we have that because it's really interesting to hear where they came from, but it's also to show that we didn't make things up, because Henry and I found as we talk to people about these words that no one believes some of them are real. For example, you know, that killing animals is called wildlife management. People have heard that, but they might not have realized that deforestation, which happens around your area a bit, is known as regeneration harvesting, which sounds like a fantastic thing to do instead of clear cutting.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention it, because we were talking about the salvage logging operation in the Klamath National Forest, and you can figure out what that's about, too.
That's a great one.
But I had to read through the material. Regeneration harvest, wait, that means clear cut.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it spun into something that sounds incredibly desirable.
Let's take some calls. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. The authors of Spinglish are Henry Beard and Christopher Cerf. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning, gentlemen. Well, where to begin? Let's see. Back in my middle school years, there was this thing called the Nixon administration. And I actually found this is what galled me, because back then they were actually having political science and debate classes in high school, which I took. And I really liked the term that the administration, and I believe the president himself said, that said he wasn't actually lying, he just misspoke himself. So that's one of them. My pet peeve with the issue is that, boy, people start using that word instead of other vocabulary terms, and it sounds like there's some kind of an epidemic going on. Everybody's sneezing all the time. Issue this and issue that. Well, let's see. You can put this in your glossary. My definition of rhetoric is it's another buzzword for hot air.
Good.
And, well, that's about it, except that, let's see, PC, that's just another term for an old term that's before PC, and that's BS. I'll take the comments off the air if I could.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it.
And BS, by the way, is dairy nutrient.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
I'd forgotten about that part. Yes, dairy nutrient.
You say so.
Whoever called it a dairy nutrient? That's got to be one-sided, too.
I think it was the industry, wasn't it, Chris?
Absolutely, the industry. I mean, do you want to be in the dairy nutrients industry or the cow manure industry?
Exactly.
Jeff, it's really a pretty easy choice.
You know, it's interesting to watch. Did a lot of this start with the military, do you think? Because, for example, I couldn't believe that there's an entry in here for the term the rest of us would call parachute.
Oh, that's right. Was it aerodynamic personnel?
Something like, yeah.
Something right.
Yeah.
And shovel, too. They have, was it personal emplacement, combat emplacement implementer? Yeah, the military loves this stuff. Both Chris and I, in our previous lives, he in the National Guard, I in the Army Reserve, had the military experience. And they just love to turn words upside down. But
well,
sometimes
there's a
they
real
do it deliberately.
For it,
yeah.
too. It's not just to make things sound more impressive. But a lot of the companies that supply these things to the military discovered that if you use word like combat emplacement tool,
right.
you can charge $1,000 for it, whereas if you say shovel, it might be only $6, you know. So there's a lot of profit in using language this way.
Hence the expensive hammers and toilet seats of years past is because they call it
Absolutely.
Something else. Sure, if you
Exactly.
call it
Jack Henry and I did a book about all of that, too, called The Pentagon Catalog years ago, where we tried to justify how great these prices were and sell these objects to the public. We didn't sell too many, though we gave away a $2,000 hex nut with every book. That was a very, very popular offering.
I can imagine. There are probably tires all over the world being held on by the hex nuts. So it seems like there actually is enough for a library here, you know, an encyclopedia collection of the books about language like this.
Yeah, and we give credit and the acknowledgments to a whole lot of people like Bill Lutz, who have been collecting this stuff for years. And there really isn't already a library that, as Chris pointed out, we refer to the authors of those books as our muses, which is a way of avoiding the fact that we basically stole stuff from them.
Yes, muse is a great word to use instead of that you plagiarize something from somebody.
Right.
And in fact, plagiarism is a term that has dozens of different ways of getting around that term. The New York Times did a whole piece about Doris Kearns Goodwin, who was accused of plagiarism without ever using the word once, because I guess the author was a friend of hers, so they just called it inappropriate borrowing.
Real, and I noticed another term in there, too, something like unsupportable citation or something like that.
Yeah, there's bad citation, duplication of a paper that's already been published, failure to use quotation marks around material.
Yes, failure to use quotation marks is a great thing to say. It sounds a lot better than being than plagiarizing a text and violating the copyright law.
Oh, wow, it really does. Christopher Cerf and Henry Beard are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. They're the co-authors of Spenglish, the Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language. You can join us at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Russell and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, everybody. I'm really enjoying this. And you guys make me recall a professor I had in college who claimed that English, being very nonspecific, if you want it to be, that it was kind of the international language of politics and money. And to his point, he spent one whole class period speaking nonstop, asked us to pay close attention, and when he finished, he asked us what he had said. And we tried to not look stupid, so we took guesses at it, but in the end, he said, "I said nothing." It was wonderful.
I love it. Good for him.
That's if you want to find him, his name is Gary Hart.
Oh,
okay. I hope it's the Gary Hart.
Was it, in fact, the Gary Hart, Russell, the former senator?
No.
No, a different Gary Hart. Okay.
If it had been, he'd be president, I'll tell you.
Right, yeah, it's a whole different way of doing things. Thanks for that call, Russell. Appreciate it. Which raises the question, then, sometimes are people using Spenglish because they really don't have something substantive to say? It's not so much that they're avoiding saying something as they don't really have anything to say, so they're just trying to fill the space and get a soundbite?
Well, jargon is used that way a lot, and we only really consider jargon to be spin or Spenglish when it's deceptively used. But you could argue that just trying to sound more important than you really are is deceptive. So a lot of those words do count. A word like that or a phrase like that I really like is zero tasking. If you say that you're zero tasking, it sounds like you're doing some modern business thing, you know, but it actually means doing nothing.
Zero tasking, sure. Not monotasking or multitasking.
No, well, zero tasking.
Well,
why not?
Some of these entries got me looking for others. For example, as everyone knows is listed in here, and that sent me looking for some people say, which I see used particularly on Fox News a fair amount. Is there similar usages there?
Yeah, those are very much the same. And typically we've found it's whenever you're either quoting somebody sitting next to you who has exactly the same political views, or it's a friend of yours, or you read it somewhere, or you want to give legitimacy to something you simply made up on the spot.
Well, I noticed that, too, when it got to the journalist part, because analyst is also in the A section there. And, you know, a lot of journalists talk about, well, analysts say, and it could be the person next to you or yourself.
Exactly.
Well, yourself, quite often.
Quite often yourself, yeah.
Or they say, you know, sources say, or a reliable source can be yourself, too.
Really? So I was thinking it was always at least a one-person remove thing, at least to talk to the guy at the snack bar who said, yeah, I think this is what they're doing, and you know, that's your source. But it doesn't even have to be that removed from you, huh?
Well, that's a highly regarded source.
Well, yes, actually, I forget who wrote this, but it's some. It might be John Leo, but a highly reliable source is often just someone who will answer your phone call, you know, if you're a reporter.
Right. You know, it's just an accident of timing. Senator Ron Wyden made himself available today to talk about the NSA, so he's going to be on in a few minutes. But
and he's in our book, actually. We're thrilled to be on the same show that he's on.
Really? How did
well,
he get
he's the one that asked the questions of the head of the NSA that led to a lot of their misleading statements.
Oh, right. This is where you really get to the parsing of language down to almost a molecular level. It's the whole Bill Clinton, you know, what the definition of is.
Absolutely.
Is there a
yeah.
relationship, that
yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And that's one of the most wonderful ones. It's like, well, like the Nixon administration. But the great thing is that the word is only means that when you're interviewing me about whether I had sex with Monica Lewinsky, I am not right then having sex with Monica Lewinsky.
Right, right. There is no relationship at this very moment.
At this moment.
Yeah,
right.
So it's like, are you having sex with her? No.
No, I mean,
I'm talking to you at the moment. I'll have sex with her again when we get off the phone, you know?
You know, I noticed when we were talking about Sarah Palin and the death panels thing, where she never actually said death panels were in the bill, but she did say death panel, Obama's death panel.
Right.
But that's an interesting thing I see in politics, too, a lot, about the juxtaposition of sentences. And George W. Bush is really good at this, where he'd say, since 9/11, blah, 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 be concerned about national security, in the next sentence, without an actual connection.
That's right.
Saddam Hussein is a big concern of ours.
Well, this is right. And those guys, that administration, and particularly the think tank that inspired a lot of their language, which was called the Project for the New American Century, they came up with a lot of terms which were very, very consciously used to mislead. Regime change is a brilliant term because it implies you're just changing governments, but it actually was used to indicate we're going to invade a country in an unprovoked way in order to change the government illegally.
And the word overthrow was never used.
They didn't bother to say that part.
Yeah.
Right, right, right. Oh, wow.
So WMD is a great term.
That's right.
Because it juxtaposes, just like you were saying, into weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, which terrify absolutely everybody, and old bottles of mustard gas are both WMD.
Oh, true.
They didn't find any of them anyway.
No.
But,
right.
So it made it even more interesting.
Christopher Cerf and Henry Beard are guests on the Jefferson Exchange, the authors of Spinglish, the Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language. I haven't even gotten into the B section yet, and right there atop the B section is proof of success. Baby carrots did what to sales?
That's right. They went through the roof. This guy, they used to discard these wretched little things, and when they were recharacterized as baby carrots, I think they increased what the consumption by 2 pounds per person per year.
Oh, it was immense. Absolutely. And, of course, I actually got into an argument with someone who interviewed us about baby carrots because they regarded that it wasn't spin because the carrots were still good to eat. What baby carrots are, actually, is there used to be misshapen, ugly carrots that got thrown away, and somebody realized that when you chopped them up into tiny little pieces and called them baby carrots, people would buy them. So I think it qualifies.
It qualifies.
It really does. Okay, so now there's an entry in the B section that's really interesting because it directs you elsewhere. Badger watching directs us watching badgers. This is a great one. Does this come back to?
Chris can explain this thoroughly.
Well, yes. There was a Welsh politician, actually, who was running for the Welsh Parliament. And he was caught by a newspaper coming out of a bush, where a photograph taken, stepping out of a bush where he had obviously had sex with somebody, which he immediately denied, of course, and announced that he had just been there watching badgers. And the phrase in England, at least, watching badgers, has come to mean having an affair, very much the way hiking the Appalachian Trail has come to mean that here, thanks to Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, who used that excuse when he was disappeared from the executive mansion for several days, and they asked him where he was, and he said hiking the Appalachian Trail when he'd actually been in Argentina with his mistress.
The book is that much funnier because of the illustrations, including a picture of Mark Sanford and his mistress on the beach, and it says Appalachian Trail aficionados.
Yes, well, they are. They love it there.
So, gentlemen, within this book, with all this great material, is there a winner, a most outrageous bending of language that you found?
Well, there's so many. I mean, it's, I can give you an extremely colorful one. The police have a term they use. If they subdue an active suspect by banging him over the back of the head with a flashlight, they call that an aluminum shampoo.
Ugh. Unless they do it with a nightstick, in which case it's called
a walnut shampoo.
There you go.
Yeah, all kinds of great stuff in the book. It's called Spinglish, a Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language. Henry Beard and Christopher Cerf wrote it and joined us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Gentlemen, we could have gone on longer. We'll give the time to Ron Wyden. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Ron Wyden, he's one of our muses.
Yes, he is indeed.
We will fill him in on that.
Great.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks, Jeff.